plane ticket. I wrote her every day and gave her the heart to come. I told her how welcome she would be, how her family would welcome her, how her husband would welcome her. I did what you, the husband, had time to do in these last 30 years. He looked directly at Moon Orchid the way the savages looked, looking for lies. "What do you want?" he asked. She shrank from his stare. It silenced her crying. "You weren't supposed to come here," he said, the front seat a barrier against the two women, over whom a spell of old age had been cast. "It's a mistake for you to be here. You can't belong. You don't have the hardness for this country. I have a new life."
"What about me?" whispered Moon Orchid.
"Good," thought Brave Orchid. "Well said. Said with no guile." "I have a new wife," said the man. "She's only your second wife," said Brave Orchid. "This is your real wife. In this country, a man may have just one wife." "So you'll get rid of that creature in your office?" asked Brave Orchid. He looked at Moon Orchid, again the rude American eyes. "You go live with your daughter. I'll mail you the money I've always sent you. I could get arrested if the Americans knew about you. I'm living like an American." He talked like a child born here. "How could you ruin her old age?" said Brave Orchid. "She has had food, she has had servants. Her daughter went to college. There wasn't anything she thought of that she couldn't buy. I have been a good husband." "You made her live like a widow." "That's not true. Obviously the villagers haven't stoned her. She's not wearing mourning. The family didn't send her away to work. Look at her. She'd never fit into an American household. I have important American guests who come into my house to eat." He turned to Moon Orchid. "You can't talk to them. You can barely talk to me."
Moon Orchid was so ashamed. She held her hands over her face. She wished she could also hide her dappled hands. Her husband looked like one of the ghosts passing the car windows, and she must look like a ghost from China. They had indeed entered the land of ghosts, and they had become ghosts.
"Do you want her to go back to China, then?" Brave Orchid was asking. "I wouldn't wish that on anyone. She may stay, but I do not want her in my house. She has to live with you, or with her daughter, and I don't want either of you coming here anymore."
Suddenly his nurse was tapping on the glass. So quickly that they might have missed it, he gestured to the old women, holding a finger to his mouth for just a moment. He had never told his American wife that he had a wife in China, and they mustn't tell her either.
"What's happening?" she asked. "Do you need help? The appointments are piling up."
"No, no," he said. "This woman fainted in the street. I'll be up soon."
They spoke to each other in English. The two old women did not call out to the young woman. Soon she left.
"I'm leaving too now," said the husband.
"Why didn't you write to tell her once and for all you weren't coming back and you weren't sending for her?" Brave Orchid asked.
"I don't know," he said. "It's as if I had turned into a different person. The new life around me was so complete, it pulled me away. You became people in a book I had read a long time ago."
"The least you can do," said Brave Orchid, "is invite us to lunch."
"Aren't you inviting us to lunch? Don't you owe us a lunch at a good restaurant?" She would not let him off easily.
So he bought them lunch. And when Brave Orchid's son came back to the car, he had to wait for them. Moon Orchid was driven back to her daughter's house, but though she lived in Los Angeles, she never saw her husband again.
"Oh, well," said Brave Orchid. "We're all under the same sky and walk the same earth. We're alive together during the same moment."
Brave Orchid and her son drove back north, Brave Orchid sitting in the back seat the whole way. Several months went by with no letter from Moon Orchid. When she had lived in China and in Hong Kong, she had written every other week. At last, Brave Orchid telephoned long distance to find out what was happening.
"I can't talk now," Moon Orchid whispered. "They're listening. Hang up quickly before they trace you."
Moon Orchid hung up on Brave Orchid before the minutes she had paid for expired. That week, a letter came from the niece saying that Moon Orchid had become afraid. Moon Orchid said that she had overheard Mexican ghosts plotting on her life. She had been creeping along the baseboards and peeping out windows. Then she had asked her daughter to help her find an apartment at the other end of Los Angeles, where she was now hiding. Her daughter visited her every day, but Moon Orchid kept telling her, "Don't come see me, because the Mexican ghosts will follow you to my new hiding place. They're watching your house." Brave Orchid phoned her niece and told her to send her mother north immediately, where there were no Mexicans, she said. "This fear is an illness," she told her niece. "I will cure her." "Long ago," she explained to her children, "when the emperors had four wives, the wife who lost in battle was sent to the northern palace. Her feet would sink little prints into the snow." Brave Orchid sat on a bench at the Greyhound station to wait for her sister. Her children had not come with her because the bus station was only a 5-block walk from the house. Her brown paper shopping bag against her, she dozed under the fluorescent lights until her sister's bus pulled into the terminal. Moon Orchid stood blinking on the stairs, hanging tightly to the railing for old people. Brave Orchid felt the tears break inside her chest for the old feet that stepped one at a time onto the cold Greyhound cement. Her sister's skin hung loose, like a hollowed frog's, as if she had shrunken inside it. Her clothes bagged, not fitting sharply anymore. "I'm in disguise," she said. Brave Orchid put her arms around her sister to give her body warmth. She held her hand along the walk home, just as they had held hands when they were girls. The house was more crowded than ever, though some of the children had gone away to school. The jade trees were inside for the winter. Along walls and on top of tables, jade trees, whose trunks were as thick as ankles, stood stoutly, green now and without the pink skin the sun gave them in the spring. "I am so afraid," said Moon Orchid. "There is no one after you," said Brave Orchid. "No Mexicans." "I saw some in the Greyhound station," said Moon Orchid. "No, no, those were Filipinos." She held her sister's earlobes and began the healing chant for being unafraid. "There are no Mexicans after you," she said. "I know. I got away from them by escaping on the bus." "Yes, you escaped on the bus with the mark of the dog on it." In the evening, when Moon Orchid seemed quieter, her sister probed into the cause of this trouble. "What made you think anyone was after you?" "I heard them talking about me. I snuck up on them and heard them. But you don't understand Mexican words. They were speaking English." "You don't understand English words." "This time, miraculously, I understood. I decoded their speech. I penetrated the words and understood what was happening inside." Brave Orchid tweaked her sister's ears for hours, chanting her new address to her, telling her how much she loved her, and how much her daughter and nephews and nieces loved her, and her brother-in-law loved her. "I won't let anything happen to you. I won't let you travel again. You're home. Stay home. Don't be afraid." Tears fell from Brave Orchid's eyes. She had whisked her sister across the ocean by jet, and they made her scurry up and down the Pacific coast, back and forth across Los Angeles. Moon Orchid had misplaced herself. Her spirit, her attention, Brave Orchid called it, scattered all over the world. Brave Orchid held her sister's head as she pulled on her earlobe. She would make it up to her. For moments, an attentiveness would return to Moon Orchid's face. Brave Orchid rubbed the slender hands, blue on the fingers, tried to stoke up the flickerings. She stayed home from the laundry day after day. She threw out the Thorazine and vitamin B that the doctor in Los Angeles had prescribed. She made Moon Orchid sit in the kitchen sun while she picked over the herbs in cupboards and basement and the fresh plants that grew in the winter garden. Brave Orchid chose the gentlest plants and made medicines and foods like those they had in their village. At night, she moved from her own bedroom and slept beside Moon Orchid.
"Don't be afraid to sleep," she said. "Rest. I'll be here beside you. I'll help your spirit find the place to come back to. I'll call it for you. You go to sleep."
Brave Orchid stayed awake, watching until dawn. Moon Orchid still described aloud her niece's and nephew's doings, but now in a monotone, and she no longer interrupted herself to ask questions. She would not go outside, even into the yard.
"Why, she's mad," Brave Orchid's husband said when she was asleep.
Brave Orchid held her hand until she appeared vague.
"Don't go away, little sister. Don't go any further. Come back to us."
If Moon Orchid fell asleep on the sofa, Brave Orchid sat up through the night, sometimes dozing in a chair. When Moon Orchid fell asleep in the middle of the bed, Brave Orchid made a place for herself at the foot. She would anchor her sister to this earth. But each day, Moon Orchid slipped further away. She said that the Mexicans had traced her to this house. That was the day she shut the drapes and blinds and locked the doors. She sidled along the walls to peep outside. Brave Orchid told her husband that he must humor his sister-in-law. It was right to shut the windows. It kept her spirit from leaking away. Then Moon Orchid went about the house, turning off the lights like during air raids. The house became gloomy, no air, no light. This was very tricky, the darkness a wide way for going as well as coming back. Sometimes Brave Orchid would switch on the lights, calling her sister's name all the while. Brave Orchid's husband installed an air conditioner. The children locked themselves up in their bedrooms, in the storeroom and basement, where they turned on the lights. Their aunt would come knocking on the doors and say, "Are you all right in there?"
"Yes, aunt, we're all right."
"Beware," she warned, "beware. Turn off your lights so you won't be found. Turn off the lights before they come for us." The children hung blankets over the cracks in the door jams. They stuffed clothes along the bottoms of the doors.
"Chinese people are very weird," they told one another.
Next, Moon Orchid removed all the photographs, except for those of the grandmother and grandfather, from the shelves, dressers, and walls. She gathered up the family albums.
"Hide these," she whispered to Brave Orchid. "Hide these. When they find me, I don't want them to trace the rest of the family.
They use photographs to trace you." Brave Orchid wrapped the pictures and the albums in flannel. "I'll carry these far away where no one will find us," she said. When Moon Orchid wasn't looking, she put them at the bottom of a storage box in the basement. She piled old clothes and old shoes on top.
"If they come for me," Moon Orchid said, "everyone will be safe."
"We're all safe," said Brave Orchid. The next odd thing Moon Orchid did was to cry whenever anyone left the house. She held on to them, pulled at their clothes, begged them not to go. The children and Brave Orchid's husband had to sneak out.
"Don't let them go," pleaded Moon Orchid. "They will never come back."
"They will come back. Wait and see, I promise you. Watch for them. Don't watch for the Mexicans. This one will be home at 3:30, this one at 5. Remember who left now. You'll see."
"We'll never see that one again," Moon Orchid wept.
At 3:30, Brave Orchid would remind her. "See, it's 3:30. Sure enough, here he comes. You children come home right after school. Don't you dare stop for a moment. No candy store, no comic book store. Do you hear?" But Moon Orchid did not remember.
"Who is this?" she asked.
"Are you going to stay with us? Don't go out tonight. Don't leave in the morning."
She whispered to Brave Orchid that the reason the family must not go out was that they would take us in airplanes and fly us to Washington, D.C., where they'd turn us into ashes. Then they'd drop the ashes in the wind, leaving no evidence. Brave Orchid saw that all variety had gone from her sister. She was indeed mad. The difference between mad people and sane people, Brave Orchid explained to the children, is that sane people have variety when they talk story. Mad people have only one story that they talk over and over. Every morning, Moon Orchid stood by the front door, whispering, whispering, "Don't go. The plains, ashes, Washington, D.C., ashes." Then when a child managed to leave, she said, "That's the last time we'll see him again. They'll get him. They'll turn him into ashes." And so Brave Orchid gave up. She was housing a mad sister who cursed the mornings for her children. The one in Vietnam, too. Their aunt was saying terrible things when they needed blessing. Perhaps Moon Orchid had already left this mad old body, and it was a ghost bad-mouthing her children. Brave Orchid finally called her niece, who put Moon Orchid in a California state mental asylum. Then Brave Orchid opened up the windows and let the air and light come into the house again. She moved back into the bedroom with her husband. The children took the blankets and sheets down from the door jams and came back into the living room. Brave Orchid visited her sister twice. Moon Orchid was thinner each time, shrunken to bone. But surprisingly, she was happy and had made up a new story. She pranced like a child.
"Oh, sister, I am so happy here. No one ever leaves. Isn't that wonderful? We are all women here. Come, I want you to meet my daughters."
She introduced Brave Orchid to each inmate in the ward, her daughters. She was especially proud of the pregnant ones.
"My dear pregnant daughters."
She touched the women on the head, straightened collars, tucked blankets.
"How are you today, dear daughter?"
"And you know," she said to Brave Orchid, "we understand one another here. We speak the same language, the very same. They understand me, and I understand them." Sure enough, the women smiled back at her and reached out to touch her as she went by. She had a new story, and yet she slipped entirely away, not waking up one morning. Brave Orchid told her children they must help her keep their father from marrying another woman, because she didn't think she could take it any better than her sister had. If he brought another woman into the house, they were to gang up on her and play tricks on her, hit her, and trip her when she was carrying hot oil until she ran away. "I am almost 70 years old," said the father, "and haven't taken a second wife, and don't plan to now." Brave Orchid's daughters decided fiercely that they would never let men be unfaithful to them. All her children made up their minds to major in science or mathematics. A Song for a Barbarian Reed Pipe. What my brother actually said was, "I drove Mom and second aunt to Los Angeles to see aunt's husband, who's got the other wife." "Did she hit him? What did she say? What did he say?" "Nothing much. Mom did all the talking." "What did she say?" "She said he'd better take them to lunch, at least." "Which wife did he sit next to? What did they eat?" "I didn't go. The other wife didn't either. He motioned us not to tell." "I would have told. If I was his wife, I would have told. I would have gone to lunch and kept my ears open." "You know, they don't talk when they eat." "What else did Mom say?" "I don't remember. I pretended a pedestrian broke her leg so he would come." "There must have been more. Didn't Aunt get in one nasty word? She must have said something." "No, I don't think she said anything. I don't remember her saying one thing." In fact, it wasn't me my brother told about going to Los Angeles. One of my sisters told me what he told her. His version of the story may be better than mine because of its bareness, not twisted into designs. The hearer can carry it tucked away without it taking up much room. Long ago in China, knot makers tied string into buttons and frogs and rope into bell poles. There was one knot so complicated that it blinded the knot maker. Finally, an emperor outlawed this cruel knot, and the nobles could not order it anymore. If I had lived in China, I would have been an outlaw knot maker. Maybe that's why my mother cut my tongue. She pushed my tongue up and sliced the freedom. Or maybe she snipped it with a pair of nail scissors. I don't remember her doing it, only her telling me about it. But all during childhood, I felt sorry for the baby whose mother waited with scissors or knife in hand for it to cry. And then, when its mouth was wide open like a baby bird's, cut.
The Chinese say a ready tongue is an evil. I used to curl up my tongue in front of the mirror and tauten my frenum into a white line, itself as thin as a razor blade. I saw no scars in my mouth. I thought perhaps I had had two frena, and she had cut one. I made other children open their mouths so I could compare theirs to mine. I saw perfect pink membranes stretching into precise edges that looked easy enough to cut. Sometimes I felt very proud that my mother committed such a powerful act upon me. At other times, I was terrified. The first thing my mother did when she saw me was to cut my tongue. "Why did you do that to me, mother?" "I told you." "Tell me again." "I cut it so that you would not be tongue-tied. Your tongue would be able to move in any language. You'll be able to speak languages that are completely different from one another. You'll be able to pronounce anything. Your frenum looked too tight to do those things. So I cut it."
"But isn't a ready tongue an evil?"
"Things are different in this ghost country." "Did it hurt me? Did I cry and bleed?" "I don't remember." "Probably." "She didn't cut the other children's. When I asked cousins and other Chinese children whether their mothers had cut their tongues loose, they said, 'What? Why didn't you cut my brothers and sisters' tongues?' They didn't need it."
"Why not? Were theirs longer than mine?"
"Why don't you quit blabbering and get to work?" "If my mother was not lying, she should have cut more. Scraped away the rest of the frenum skin. Because I have a terrible time talking. Or she should not have cut at all. Tampering with my speech. When I went to kindergarten and had to speak English for the first time, I became silent. A dumbness, a shame, still cracks my voice in two even when I want to say hello casually, or ask an easy question in front of the checkout counter, or ask directions of a bus driver. I stand frozen, or I hold up the line with the complete grammatical sentence that comes squeaking out at impossible length.
"What did you say?" says the cab driver. "Or speak up!"
So I have to perform again, only weaker the second time. A telephone call makes my throat bleed and takes up that day's courage. It spoils my day with self-disgust when I hear my broken voice come skittering out into the open. It makes people wince to hear it. I'm getting better, though. Recently, I asked the postman for special issue stamps. I've waited since childhood for postmen to give me some of their own accord. I am making progress, a little every day. My silence was thickest, total, during the 3 years that I covered my school paintings with black paint. I painted layers of black over houses and flowers and suns, and when I drew on the blackboard, I put a layer of chalk on top. I was making a stage curtain, and it was the moment before the curtain parted or rose. The teachers called my parents to school, and I saw they had been saving my pictures, curling and cracking, all alike and black. The teachers pointed to the pictures and looked serious, talked seriously, too. But my parents did not understand English.
"The parents and teachers of criminals were executed," said my father.
My parents took the pictures home. I spread them out, so black and full of possibilities, and pretended the curtains were swinging open, flying up, one after another. Sunlight underneath, mighty operas. During the first silent year, I spoke to no one at school, did not ask before going to the lavatory, and flunked kindergarten. My sister also said nothing for 3 years, silent in the playground and silent at lunch. There were other quiet Chinese girls not of our family, but most of them got over it sooner than we did. I enjoyed the silence. At first, it did not occur to me I was supposed to talk or to pass kindergarten. I talked at home, and to one or two of the Chinese kids in class, I made motions and even made some jokes. I drank out of a toy saucer when the water spilled out of the cup, and everybody laughed, pointing at me. So I did it some more. I didn't know that Americans don't drink out of saucers. I liked the Negro students, black ghosts, best, because they laughed the loudest and talked to me as if I were a daring talker, too. One of the Negro girls had her mother coil braids over her ears, Shanghai style, like mine. We were Shanghai twins, except that she was covered with black, like my paintings.
Two Negro kids enrolled in Chinese school, and the teachers gave them Chinese names. Some Negro kids walked me to school and home, protecting me from the Japanese kids, who hit me and chased me and stuck gum in my ears. The Japanese kids were noisy and tough. They appeared one day in kindergarten, released from concentration camp, which was a tic-tac-toe mark, like barbed wire on the map. It was when I found out that I had to talk that school became a misery, that the silence became a misery. I did not speak and felt bad each time that I did not speak. I read aloud in first grade, though, and heard the barest whisper with little squeaks come out of my throat. "Louder," said the teacher, who scared the voice away again. The other Chinese girls did not talk either, so I knew the silence had to do with being a Chinese girl. Reading out loud was easier than speaking because we did not have to make up what to say. But I stopped often, and the teacher would think I'd gone quiet again. I could not understand I. The Chinese I has seven strokes, intricacies. How could the American I, assuredly wearing a hat like the Chinese, have only three strokes, the middle, so straight? Was it out of politeness that this writer left off strokes the way a Chinese has to write her own name small and crooked? No, it was not politeness. I is a capital, and U is lowercase. I stared at that middle line and waited so long for its black center to resolve into tight strokes and dots that I forgot to pronounce it. The other troublesome word was here. No strong consonant to hang on to, and so flat, when here is two mountainous ideographs. The teacher, who had already told me every day how to read I and here, put me in the lower corner under the stairs again, where the noisy boys usually sat. When my second grade class did a play, the whole class went to the auditorium except the Chinese girls. The teacher, lovely and Hawaiian, should have understood about us, but instead left us behind in the classroom. Our voices were too soft or non-existent, and our parents never signed the permission slips anyway. They never signed anything unnecessary. We opened the door a crack and peeked out, but closed it again quickly. One of us, not me, won every spelling bee, though. I remember telling the Hawaiian teacher, "We Chinese can't sing Land Where Our Fathers Died." She argued with me about politics, while I meant because of curses. But how can I have that memory when I couldn't talk? My mother says that we, like the ghosts, have no memories. After American school, we picked up our cigar boxes in which we had arranged books and an ink box neatly, and went to Chinese school from 5 to 7:30 p.m. There we chanted together, voices rising and falling, loud and soft, some boys shouting, everybody reading together, reciting together, and not alone, with one voice. When we had a memorization test, the teacher let each of us come to his desk and say the lesson to him privately, while the rest of the class practiced copying or tracing. Most of the teachers were men. The boys who were so well behaved in the American school played tricks on them and talked back to them. The girls were not mute. They screamed and yelled during recess when there were no rules. They had fist fights. Nobody was afraid of children hurting themselves or of children hurting school property. The glass doors with the red and green balconies with the gold joy symbols were left wide open so that we could run out and climb the fire escapes. We played Capture the Flag in the auditorium, where Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek's pictures hung at the back of the stage, the Chinese flag on their left and the American flag on their right. We climbed the teak ceremonial chairs and made flying leaps off the stage. One flag headquarters was behind the glass door and the other on stage right. Our feet drummed on the hollow stage. During recess, the teachers locked themselves up in their office with the shelves of books, copybooks, inks from China. They drank tea and warmed their hands at a stove. There was no play supervision. At recess, we had the school to ourselves. And also, we could roam as far as we could go, downtown, Chinatown, stores, home, as long as we returned before the bell rang. At exactly 7:30, the teacher again picked up the brass bell that sat on his desk and swung it over our heads. While we charged down the stairs, our cheering magnified in the stairwell. Nobody had to line up. Not all of the children who were silent at American school found voice at Chinese school. One new teacher said each of us had to get up and recite in front of the class, who was to listen. My sister and I had memorized the lesson perfectly. We said it to each other at home, one chanting, one listening. The teacher called my sister to recite first. It was the first time a teacher had called on the second-born to go first. My sister was scared. She glanced at me and looked away. I looked down at my desk. I hoped that she would do it because if she could, then I would have to. She opened her mouth, and a voice came out that wasn't a whisper, but it wasn't a proper voice either. I hoped that she would not cry, fear breaking up her voice like twigs underfoot. She sounded as if she were trying to sing, though weeping and strangling. She did not pause or stop to end the embarrassment. She kept going until she said the last word, and then she sat down. When it was my turn, the same voice came out, a crippled animal running on broken legs. You could hear splinters in my voice, bones rubbing jagged against one another. I was loud, though. I was glad I didn't whisper. There was one little girl who whispered. You can't entrust your voice to the Chinese, either. They want to capture your voice for their own use. They want to fix up your tongue to speak for them. How much less can you sell it for, we have to ask. Talk to sales ghosts down. Make them take a loss. We were working at the laundry when a delivery boy came from the Rexall drugstore around the corner. He had a pale blue box of pills, but nobody was sick. Reading the label, we saw that it belonged to another Chinese family, Crazy Mary's family. Not ours, said my father. He pointed out the name to the delivery ghost, who took the pills back. My mother muttered for an hour, and then her anger boiled over. That ghost! That dead ghost! How dare he come to the wrong house! She could not concentrate on her marking and pressing. A mistake! Huh! I was getting angry myself. She fumed. She made her press crash and hiss. Revenge. We've got to avenge this wrong on our future, on our health, on our lives. Nobody's going to sicken my children and get away with it. We brothers and sisters did not look at one another. She would do something awful, something embarrassing. She had already been hinting that during the next eclipse, we'd slam pot lids together to scare the frog from swallowing the moon. The word for eclipse is frog swallowing the moon. When we had not banged lids at the last eclipse and the shadow kept receding anyway, she'd said, "The villagers must be banging and clanging very loudly back home in China." On the other side of the world, they aren't having an eclipse, Mama. That's just the shadow the earth makes when it comes between the moon and the sun. You're always believing what those ghost teachers tell you. Look at the size of the jaws. Aha, she yelled. You, the biggest. She was pointing at me. You go to the drugstore. What do you want me to buy, Mother? I said. Buy nothing. Don't bring 1 cent. Go and make them stop the curse. I don't want to go. I don't know how to do that. There are no such thing as curses. They'll think I'm crazy. If you don't go, I'm holding you responsible for bringing a plague to this family. What am I supposed to do when I get there? I said, sullen, trapped. Do I say, your delivery boy made a wrong delivery? They know he made a wrong delivery. I want you to make them rectify their crime. I felt sick already. She'd make me swing stinky censers around the counter at the druggist, at the customers, throw dog blood on the druggist. I couldn't stand her plans. You get reparation candy, she said. You say, you have tainted my house with sick medicine and must return the curse with sweetness. He'll understand. He didn't do it on purpose, and no, he won't, Mother. They don't understand stuff like that. I won't be able to say it right. He'll call us beggars. You just translate. She searched me to make sure I wasn't hiding any money. I was sneaky and bad enough to buy the candy and come back pretending it was a free gift.
"My mother says to give me some candy,"
I said to the druggist. "Be cute and small. No one hurts the cute and small." "What? Speak up. Speak English," he said, big in his white druggist coat.
Give me some candy?"
The druggist leaned way over the counter and frowned.
"Some free candy," I said. "Sample candy?"
"We don't give sample candy, young lady," he said.
"My mother said you have to give us candy. She said that this is the way the Chinese do it."
"What?"
"That is the way the Chinese do it."
"Do what?"
"Do things." I felt the weight and immensity of things impossible to explain to the druggist.
"Can I give you some money?" he asked.
"No, we want candy."
He reached into a jar and gave me a handful of lollipops. He gave us candy all year round, year after year, every time we went into the drugstore. When different druggists or clerks waited on us, they also gave us candy. They had talked us over. They gave us Halloween candy in December, Christmas candy around Valentine's Day, candy hearts at Easter, and Easter eggs at Halloween.
"See," said our mother, "they understand. You kids just aren't very brave."
But I knew they did not understand. They thought we were beggars without a home who lived in back of the laundry. They felt sorry for us. I did not eat their candy. I did not go inside the drugstore or walk past it unless my parents forced me to. Whenever we had a prescription filled, the druggist put candy in the medicine bag. This is what Chinese druggists normally do, except they give raisins. My mother thought she taught the druggist ghosts a lesson in good manners, which is the same word as traditions. My mouth went permanently crooked with effort, turned down on the left side and straight on the right. How strange that the immigrant villagers are shouters, hollering face to face. My father asks, "Why is it I can hear Chinese from blocks away? Is it that I understand the language, or is it that they talk loud?" They turn the radio up full blast to hear the operas, which do not seem to hurt their ears. And they yell over the singers that wail over the drums, everybody talking at once, big arm gestures, spit flying. You can see the disgust on American faces looking at women like that. It isn't just the loudness. It is the way Chinese sounds. Ching chong ugly to American ears, not beautiful like Japanese sayonara words with the consonants and vowels as regular as Italian. We make guttural peasant noise and have tongue duck tang names you can't remember. And the Chinese can't hear Americans at all. The language is too soft and Western music unhearable. I've watched a Chinese audience laugh, visit, talk story, and holler during a piano recital as if the musician could not hear them. A Chinese American, somebody's son, was playing Chopin, which has no punctuation, no cymbals, no gongs. Chinese piano music is five black keys. Normal Chinese women's voices are strong and bossy. We American Chinese girls had to whisper to make ourselves American feminine. Apparently, we whispered even more softly than the Americans. Once a year, my teachers referred my sister and me to speech therapy, but our voices would straighten out unpredictably normal for the therapists. Some of us gave up, shook our heads, and said nothing, not a word. Some of us could not even shake our heads. At times, shaking my head no is more self-assertion than I can manage. Most of us eventually found some voice, however faltering. We invented an American feminine speaking personality, except for that one girl who could not speak up even in Chinese school. She was a year older than I and was in my class for 12 years. During all those years, she read aloud but would not talk. Her older sister was usually beside her. Their parents kept the older daughter back to protect the younger one. They were 6 and 7 years old when they began school. Although I had flunked kindergarten, I was the same age as most other students in our class. My parents had probably lied about my age, so I had had a head start and came out even.
My younger sister was in the class below me. We were normal ages and normally separated. The parents of the quiet girl, on the other hand, protected both daughters. When it sprinkled, they kept them home from school. The girls did not work for a living the way we did. But in other ways, we were the same. We were similar in sports. We held the bat on our shoulders until we walked to first base. You got a strike only when you actually struck at the ball. Sometimes the pitcher wouldn't bother to throw to us. "Automatic walk," the other children would call, sending us on our way. By fourth or fifth grade, though, some of us would try to hit the ball. "Easy out," the other kids would say. I hit the ball a couple of times. Baseball was nice in that there was a definite spot to run to after hitting the ball. Basketball confused me because when I caught the ball, I didn't know whom to throw it to. "Me, me," the kids would be yelling. "Over here." Suddenly, it would occur to me I hadn't memorized which ghosts were on my team and which were on the other. When the kids said, "Automatic walk," the girl who was quieter than I kneeled with one end of the bat in each hand and placed it carefully on the plate. Then she dusted her hands as she walked to first base, where she rubbed her hands softly, fingers spread. She always got tagged out before second base. She would whisper read, but not talk. Her whisper was as soft as if she had no muscles. She seemed to be breathing from a distance. I heard no anger or tension. I joined in at lunchtime when the other students, the Chinese too, talked about whether or not she was mute, although obviously she was not, if she could read aloud. People told how they had tried their best to be friendly. They said hello, but if she refused to answer, well, they didn't see why they had to say hello anymore. She had no friends of her own, but followed her sister everywhere, although people and she herself probably thought I was her friend. I also followed her sister about, who was fairly normal. She was almost 2 years older and read more than anyone else. I hated the younger sister, the quiet one. I hated her when she was the last chosen for her team and I the last chosen for my team. I hated her for her China doll haircut. I hated her at music time for the wheezes that came out of her plastic flute. One afternoon in the sixth grade, that year I was arrogant with talk, not knowing there was going to be high school dances and college seminars to set me back. I and my little sister and the quiet girl and her big sister stayed late after school for some reason. The cement was cooling, and the tetherball poles made shadows across the gravel. The hooks at the rope ends were clinking against the poles. We shouldn't have been so late. There was laundry work to do in Chinese school to get to by 5. The last time we had stayed late, my mother had phoned the police and told them we had been kidnapped by bandits. The radio stations broadcast our descriptions. I had to get home before she did that again. But sometimes, if you loitered long enough in the schoolyard, the other children would have gone home and you could play with the equipment before the office took it away. We were chasing one another through the playground and in and out of the basement where the playroom and lavatory were. During air raid drills, it was during the Korean War, which you knew about because every day the front page of the newspaper printed a map of Korea with the top part red and going up and down like a window shade. We curled up in this basement. Now everyone was gone. The playroom was army green and had nothing in it but a long trough with drinking spigots in rows. Pipes across the ceiling led to the drinking fountains and to the toilets in the next room. When someone flushed, you could hear the water and other matter, which the children named, running inside the big pipe above the drinking spigots. There was one playroom for girls next to the girls' lavatory and one playroom for boys next to the boys' lavatory. The stalls were open, and the toilets had no lids, by which we knew that ghosts had no sense of shame or privacy. Inside the playroom, the light bulbs in cages had already been turned off. Daylight came in X patterns through the caging at the windows. I looked out, and seeing no one in the schoolyard, ran outside to climb the fire escape upside down, hanging on to the metal stairs with fingers and toes. I did a flip off the fire escape and ran across the schoolyard. The day was a great eye, and it was not paying much attention to me now. I could disappear with the sun. I could turn quickly sideways and slip into a different world. It seemed I could run faster at this time, and by evening I would be able to fly. As the afternoon wore on, we could run into the forbidden places. The boys' big yard. The boys' playroom. We could go into the boys' lavatory and look at the urinals. The only time during school hours I had crossed the boys' yard was when a flatbed truck with a giant thing covered with canvas and tied down with ropes had parked across the street. The children had told one another that it was a gorilla in captivity. We couldn't decide whether the sign said Trail of the Gorilla or Trial of the Gorilla. The thing was as big as a house. The teachers couldn't stop us from hysterically running to the fence and clinging to the wire mesh. Now I ran across the boys' yards clear to the cyclone fence and thought about the hair that I had seen sticking out of the canvas. It was going to be summer soon, so you could feel that freedom coming on, too. I ran back into the girls' yard, and there was the quiet sister, all by herself. I ran past her, and she followed me into the girls' lavatory. My footsteps rang hard against cement and tile because of the taps I had nailed into my shoes. Her footsteps were soft, padding after me. There was no one in the lavatory but the two of us. I ran all around the rows of 25 open stalls to make sure of that. No sisters. I think we must have been playing hide-and-go-seek. She was not good at hiding by herself and usually followed her sister. They'd hide in the same place. They must have gotten separated. In this growing twilight, a child could hide and never be found. I stopped abruptly in front of the sinks, and she came running toward me before she could stop herself so that she almost collided with me. I walked closer. She backed away, puzzlement, then alarm in her eyes. "You're going to talk," I said, my voice steady and normal as it is when talking to the familiar, the weak, and the small. "I am going to make you talk, you sissy girl." She stopped backing away and stood fixed. I looked into her face so I could hate it close up. She wore black bangs, and her cheeks were pink and white. She was baby soft. I thought that I could put my thumb on her nose and push it bonelessly in, indent her face. I could poke dimples into her cheeks. I could work her face around like dough. She stood still, and I did not want to look at her face anymore. I hated fragility. I walked around her, looked her up and down the way the Mexican and Negro girls did when they fought, so tough. I hated her weak neck, the way it did not support her head but let it droop. Her head would fall backward. I stared at the curve of her nape. I wished I was able to see what my own neck looked like from the back and sides. I hoped it did not look like hers. I wanted a stout neck. I grew my hair long to hide it in case it was a flower stem neck. I walked around to the front of her to hate her face some more. I reached up and took the fatty part of her cheek, not dough but meat, between my thumb and finger. This close, and I saw no pores. "Talk," I said. "Are you going to talk?" Her skin was fleshy, like squid out of which the glassy blades of bones had been pulled. I wanted tough skin, hard brown skin. I had calloused my hands. I had scratched dirt to blacken the nails, which I cut straight across to make stubby fingers. I gave her face a squeeze. "Talk." When I let go, the pink rushed back into my white thumbprint on her skin. I walked around to her side. "Talk!" I shouted into the side of her head. Her straight hair hung, the same all these years, no ringlets or braids or permanents. I squeezed her other cheek. "Are you, huh? Are you going to talk?" She tried to shake her head, but I had hold of her face. She had no muscles to jerk away. Her skin seemed to stretch. I let go in horror. What if it came away in my hand? No, huh? I said, rubbing the touch of her off my fingers. Say no, then, I said. I gave her another pinch and a twist. Say no! She shook her head, her straight hair turning with her head, not swinging side to side like the pretty girls. She was so neat. Her neatness bothered me. I hated the way she folded the wax paper from her lunch. She did not wad her brown paper bag and her school papers. I hated her clothes. The blue pastel cardigan, the white blouse with the collar that lay flat over the cardigan, the homemade flat cotton skirt she wore when everybody else was wearing flared skirts. I hated pastels. I would wear black, always. I squeezed again, harder, even though her cheek had a weak, rubbery feeling I did not like. I squeezed one cheek, then the other, back and forth until the tears ran out of her eyes as if I had pulled them out. "Stop crying," I said. But although she habitually followed me around, she did not obey. Her eyes dripped, her nose dripped. She wiped her eyes with her papery fingers. The skin on her hands and arms seemed powdery dry like tracing paper, onion skin. I hated her fingers. I could snap them like breadsticks. I pushed her hands down. Say hi, I said. Hi, like that. Say your name. Go ahead. Say it. Or are you stupid? You're so stupid. You don't know your own name. Is that it? When I say, what's your name? You just blurt it out, okay? What's your name? Last year, the whole class had laughed at a boy who couldn't fill out a form because he didn't know his father's name. The teacher sighed, exasperated, and was very sarcastic. Don't you notice things? What does your mother call him? She said. The class laughed at how dumb he was not to notice things. She calls him father of me, he said. Even we laughed, although we knew that his mother did not call his father by name, and a son does not know his father's name. We laughed and were relieved that our parents had had the foresight to tell us some names we could give the teachers. If you're not stupid, I said to the quiet girl, what's your name? She shook her head, and some hair caught in the tears. Wet black hair stuck to the side of the pink and white face. I reached up. She was taller than I, and took a strand of hair. I pulled it. Well, then, let's honk your hair, I said. Honk, honk! Then I pulled the other side. Honk! A long pull. Honk! A longer pull. I could see her little white ears like white cutworms curled underneath the hair. Talk! I yelled into each cutworm. I looked right at her. I know you talk, I said. I've heard you. Her eyebrows flew up. Something in those black eyes was startled, and I pursued it. I was walking past your house when you didn't know I was there. I heard you yell in English and in Chinese. You weren't just talking, you were shouting. I heard you shout. You were saying, where are you? Say that again. Go ahead, just the way you did at home. I yanked harder on the hair, but steadily, not jerking. I did not want to pull it out. Go ahead. Say, where are you? Say it loud enough for your sister to come. Call her. Make her come help you. Call her name. I'll stop if she comes. So call. Go ahead. She shook her head, her mouth curved down, crying. I could see her tiny white teeth, baby teeth. I wanted to grow big, strong yellow teeth. You do have a tongue, I said, so use it. I pulled the hair at her temples, pulled the tears out of her eyes. Say ow, I said. Just ow. Say let go. Go ahead, say it. I'll honk you again if you don't say let me alone. Say leave me alone, and I'll let you go. I will. I'll let you go if you say it. You can stop this any time you want to, you know. All you have to do is tell me to stop. Just say stop. You're just asking for it, aren't you? You're just asking for another honk. Well, then I'll have to give you another honk. Say stop. But she didn't. I had to pull again and again. Sounds did come out of her mouth. Sobs, chokes, noises that were almost words. Snot ran out of her nose. She tried to wipe it with her hands, but there was too much of it. She used her sleeve. You're disgusting, I told her. Look at you, snot streaming down your nose, and you won't say a word to stop it. You're such a nothing.
I moved behind her and pulled the hair growing out of her weak neck. I let go. I stood silent for a long time. Then I screamed, "Talk!" I would scare the words out of her. If she had had little bound feet, the toes twisted under the balls, I would have jumped up and landed on them, crunch, stomped on them with my iron shoes. She cried hard, sobbing aloud. "Cry, Mama," I said. "Come on! Cry, Mama! Say stop it!"
I put my finger on her pointed chin. "I don't like you. I don't like the weak little toots you make on your flute. Wheeze, wheeze. I don't like the way you don't swing at the ball. I don't like the way you're the last one chosen. I don't like the way you can't make a fist for tetherball. Why don't you make a fist? Come on. Get tough. Come on. Throw fists."
I pushed at her long hands. They swung limply at her sides. Her fingers were so long, I thought maybe they had an extra joint. They couldn't possibly make fists like other people's.
"Make a fist," I said. "Come on, just fold those fingers up. Fingers on the inside, thumbs on the outside. Say something." "Honk me back. You're so tall, and you let me pick on you? Would you like a hanky? I can't get you one with embroidery on it or crocheting along the edges, but I'll get you some toilet paper if you tell me to. Go ahead, ask me. I'll get it for you if you ask."
She did not stop crying.
"Why don't you scream help?" I suggested. "Say help. Go ahead."
She cried on.
"Okay. Okay. Don't talk. Just scream. And I'll let you go. Won't that feel good? Go ahead. Like this." I screamed, not too loudly.
My voice hit the tile and rang it as if I had thrown a rock at it. The stalls opened wider and the toilets wider and darker. Shadows leaned at angles I had not seen before. It was very late. Maybe a janitor had locked me in with this girl for the night. Her black eyes blinked and stared. I felt dizzy from hunger. We had been in this lavatory together forever. My mother would call the police again if I didn't bring my sister home soon.
"I'll let you go if you say just one word," I said. "You can even say or the, and I'll let you go. Come on, please."
She didn't shake her head anymore. Only cried steadily, so much water coming out of her. I could see the two duct holes where the tears welled out. Quarts of tears, but no words. I grabbed her by the shoulder. I could feel bones. The light was coming in queerly through the frosted glass with the chicken wire embedded in it. Her crying was like an animal's, a seal's, and it echoed around the basement.
"Do you want to stay here all night?" I asked. "Your mother is wondering what happened to her baby. You wouldn't want to have her mad at you. You better say something."
I shook her shoulder. I pulled her hair again. I squeezed her face.
"Come on! Talk! Talk! Talk!"
She didn't seem to feel it anymore when I pulled her hair. "There's nobody here but you and me. This isn't a classroom or a playground or a crowd. I'm just one person. You can talk in front of one person. Don't make me pull harder and harder until you talk." But her hair seemed to stretch. She did not say a word. "I'm going to pull harder. Don't make me pull anymore or your hair will come out and you're going to be bald. Do you want to be bald? You don't want to be bald, do you?" Far away, coming from the edge of town, I heard whistles blow. The cannery was changing shifts, letting out the afternoon people, and still we were here at school. It was a sad sound, work done. The air was lonelier after the sound died.
"Why won't you talk?" I started to cry.
What if I couldn't stop and everyone would want to know what happened?
"Now look what you've done," I scolded. "You're going to pay for this. I want to know why. And you're going to tell me why. You don't see I'm trying to help you out, do you? Do you want to be like this, dumb? Do you know what dumb means? Your whole life? Don't you ever want to be a cheerleader or a pom-pom girl? What are you going to do for a living? Yeah, you're going to have to work because you can't be a housewife. Somebody has to marry you before you can be a housewife. And you are a plant. Do
Do you know that? That's all you are if you don't talk. If you don't talk, you can't have a personality. You'll have no personality and no hair. You've got to let people know you have a personality and a brain. You think somebody is going to take care of you all your stupid life? You think you'll always have your big sister? You think somebody's going to marry you? Is that it? Well, you're not the type that gets dates, let alone gets married. Nobody's going to notice you, and you have to talk for interviews, speak right up in front of the boss. Don't you know that? You're so dumb. Why do I waste my time on you? Sniffling and snorting, I couldn't stop crying and talking at the same time. I kept wiping my nose on my arm, my sweater lost somewhere, probably not worn because my mother said to wear a sweater. It seemed as if I had spent my life in that basement doing the worst thing I had yet done to another person. I'm doing this for your own good, I said. Don't you dare tell anyone I've been bad to you. Talk! Please talk! I was getting dizzy from the air I was gulping. Her sobs and my sobs were bouncing wildly off the tile, sometimes together, sometimes alternating.
I don't understand why you won't say just one word, I cried, clenching my teeth.
My knees were shaking, and I hung onto her hair to stand up. Another time I'd stayed too late, I had to walk around two Negro kids who were bonking each other's head on the concrete. I went back later to see if the concrete had cracks in it.
Look, I'll give you something if you talk. I'll give you my pencil box. I'll buy you some candy, okay? What do you want? Tell me, just say it and I'll give it to you. Just say yes or okay or baby roof.
But she didn't want anything. I had stopped pinching her cheek because I did not like the feel of her skin. I would go crazy if it came away in my hands. I skinned her, I would have to confess. Suddenly, I heard footsteps hurrying through the basement, and her sister ran into the lavatory calling her name.
Oh, there you are, I said. We've been waiting for you. I was only trying to teach her to talk. She wouldn't cooperate, though.
Her sister went into one of the stalls and got handfuls of toilet paper and wiped her off. Then we found my sister, and we walked home together. Your family really ought to force her to speak, I advised all the way home. You mustn't pamper her. The world is sometimes just, and I spent the next 18 months sick in bed with a mysterious illness. There was no pain and no symptoms, though the middle line in my left palm broke in two. Instead of starting junior high school, I lived like the Victorian recluses I read about. I had a rented hospital bed in the living room where I watched soap operas on TV, and my family cranked me up and down. I saw no one but my family, who took good care of me. I could have no visitors, no other relatives, no villagers. My bed was against a west window, and I watched the seasons change the peach tree. I had a bell to ring for help. I used a bedpan. It was the best year and a half of my life. Nothing happened. But one day my mother, the doctor, said, "You're ready to get up today. It's time to get up and go to school." I walked about outside to get my legs working, leaning on a staff I cut from the peach tree. The sky and trees, the sun, were immense, no longer framed by a window, no longer grayed with a fly screen. I sat down on the sidewalk in amazement, the night, the stars. But at school, I had to figure out again how to talk. I met again the poor girl I had tormented. She had not changed. She wore the same clothes, haircut, and manner as when we were in elementary school. No makeup on the pink and white face, while the other Asian girls were starting to tape their eyelids. She continued to be able to read aloud, but there was hardly any reading aloud anymore, less and less as we got into high school.